Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, shining a spotlight this week on the USS Indianapolis as we mark 76 years since that cruiser's fateful sinking, followed by the heroic rescue of 317 members of her crew of nearly 1,200. It's quite likely that zero would have survived without the man survivors have long referred to as their angel, Chuck Gwynn, and his unexpected discovery on August 2, 1945. As Harold Bray recalls, the Indianapolis had never been reported sunk or missing when Gwynn spotted some of the survivors from his PV-1 Ventura.
He just seen us by accident. He wasn't even looking for us.
What did you say to him the first time you got to meet him?
I think I kissed him. I don't know.
Is there any doubt in your mind whether or not you'd be alive if he didn't see you?
Because we were in the water 4 days already. Nobody saw us. If they did, they ignored us. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, there was, when we first hit the water, it was like 1,100 of us in the water. If you were hurt, you weren't lasting, but it just died off. Every day we were burying guys, and it was not a good sight to even think about, you know. It was quite an experience.
The plane comes over, so you know you've been spotted. But then it's another day and a half before they come back.
Yeah.
Seems like that might be the longest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was, where are they? Where are they? They're never here. Where are they? Of course, we were like 200 miles off of land, any land. So a ship, even traveling at 6 knots, takes a while to cover 200 miles. And at one point, there were 6 ships. Came to the rescue, and the Bassett was one I got on. She was the first one there, and see, when I got picked up, I was by myself.
Well, and the reason you were by yourself, I think, is because you saw them drop something from the plane. They dropped a sono buoy, but you thought it was water?
Yeah, I hung on to that till, but then I got on a raft by myself.
Okay. I think I read that you were actually asleep or had your eyes closed when they shined a light on your face?
Yeah, when they picked us up, yeah, I was sleeping, and then hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? With everything that you'd been through, when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett, and you know for the first time you're actually going to live, what did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us. I don't think he was high enough to see us, but he seen the oil slick. We were in the oil, and that's how we got discovered.
He thought maybe he'd find a Japanese submarine to shoot at or something.
I guess that was what he said, yeah.
Was there ever a point in those 5 days where you thought about giving up?
I practically did because I was getting tired. Of course, there was more room on the raft by that time. You know, I could sit. It was not a raft. It was a rope.
A rope net that you could get on top of and sit.
But you're still in the water.
Yeah.
Up to your neck, holding your head up.
But you don't have to actively hold on with your arms anymore.
No, nothing. We're hanging on to each other until everybody was gone, you know. But just lucky. Just the guys that lived through it was just lucky.
And they took you to the hospital in the Philippines, I believe?
Samara, yeah.
How long did it take you to recover?
I don't know. They flew us to a hospital out of the Philippines and flew us to a hospital in Guam. So we were in Guam maybe a month and a half. I remember hospital 18. I'll never forget that. Then we went from there to San Diego. Spent some time in a hospital there. I was based at an air base in Detroit after that.
But it was while you were in the hospital, I think, that you first learned, hey, that crate that we took to Tinian, that was the atomic bomb that pretty much ended the war.
Yeah.
Was that kind of an eye-opening realization that that's what it was?
Well, nobody knew about the skipper didn't even know.
Yeah.
It's a big secret till they dropped it.
And speaking of the skipper, because there was such a great loss of life on your ship, it was such a disaster. So many things went wrong. People were looking for someone to blame.
Yeah. Well, he took the blame. He committed suicide for that reason, I guess, because he was getting nasty letters from the mothers and dads, and we would have got hit no matter what. It was they were just out looking for us. I got to know him.
Yeah. And in fact, the commander of that Japanese submarine, I-58, Hashimoto, even came to the U.S. to testify in the court-martial that I would have gotten him whether he zigzagged or not.
Yeah.
And they still convicted him.
Yeah.
So you and your fellow survivors are living with that, bothered by that. He commits suicide in the 60s. And then in the 90s, a 12-year-old, I believe he was a 12-year-old kid in Florida, Hunter Scott, gets into this story and gets the Senate's attention. And they finally retry this case, basically, in Congress and clear his name, exonerate him.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you and your fellow survivors?
Well, finally got it right, you know. No matter what, we were just in a position where we were going to get hit no matter what. It was no accident the Japs were out looking for us. So I was just so lucky because sleeping where I was supposed to be sleeping. That's where the two torpedoes hit.
Yeah.
And I happened to be sleeping three decks higher. Just a matter of luck.
There's a lot of what-ifs in your story.
Yeah.
How do you explain them all?
Just a matter of luck. That's all I can say. Oh, she's waving her hand. Things to do.
Your wife believes that God was protecting you so she could marry you someday.
Yeah, that's what she says, yeah. It was just a matter of luck. They weren't even looking for us. I can see it today coming over the horizon, coming right at us. When he came over, I can see him do his wings. And he went out and came back, did it again, and he went straight up. That's when he radioed what he had. But he was our angel ever since then. As a matter of fact, that's what we called him, the angel. Because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking. It was amazing going through that. I don't know how anybody ever lived through it. It was the weather saved us because we didn't have any rough weather, and most of us were hurt. If we had any storms, I don't think it would have lived through it. But we had pretty good weather for 4 days. As a matter of fact, the night we got picked up, I think we hit some rough weather. I got picked up at a little bit after 1 o'clock in the morning. I was picked up, and I think I was the first one aboard the Bassett.
Again, just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're 18 when this all happens. So you've lived the last 75 years with that experience in mind.
Never leaves.
How has that impacted the way you've lived your life since?
Just appreciate what I had, because we lost 880 guys that never had that chance. Whoever got in the water, if they were hurt, they didn't live very long. And all I had was burns on my left side. I wasn't hurt very bad, but there was guys in some bad shape. No matter what they do, you'll never can imagine what we went through while in the water. I can't even tell you what it was like. Nobody should go through stuff like that. You're dodging sharks, and then you're dodging guys that are going nuts, attacking you. I'm telling you, I just so lucky to get through that.
That is Harold Bray, now one of just five remaining survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis 76 years ago. We'll hear from another survivor shortly, but first, a different perspective. You heard Harold talk about the speculation as to what the Marines were guarding aboard ship. Mo Rana, the son of Italian immigrants and one of three brothers to serve in World War II, was one of the Marines who unloaded that special cargo on Tinian, where he was assigned to a radar unit with the 17th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. In fact, one of the men he competed against in softball games there was the pilot who would eventually fly the Enola Gay on its mission to Hiroshima, Paul Tibbetts.
We took the island, and the B-29s were coming in, and the security was secured for the island with our radar and everything. We had a lot of time on our hands, and what would happen is the B-29 pilots from Saipan would fly over to Tinian, and we'd play ball with them. Mm-hmm. Baseball. They come in with a team, and we'd have a team, and somebody beat somebody, and then they'd leave because they had a mission to go to at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the heartbreak of this was, if I played ball with you today, the next day when you expect them to come back to play again, then we got the word from their comrades that they were shot down over Japan. Mm-hmm. We never seen them again. That was a real thing that we had to look forward to. Are we going to see you again? But at the same time, we were enjoying ourselves with them. Everybody wasn't thinking about the world. We were playing ball and everything. But we knew what we had to do, and it was kind of bad. We as Marines on an island, we didn't have any food. We had little C rations, a little can of beans for our meals. No K rations, no anything like that. And every now and then, when the Army start coming into the island, they start bringing up the food, like K rations and peaches and the fruit and all that stuff. But we weren't getting any of it. So the word would come out that a ship was coming in with some food, and they needed a couple of trucks from our outfit to go help unload these ships to bring the food to the Army dump. So we volunteered. We were always the last two trucks in the train. They're probably about 25, 30 trucks.
Uh-huh.
We were always the last two trucks. And so when our trucks come in time for the food, the word would get to us down in the hole, our trucks are here. Okay. Everything that went on those two trucks was ours.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're taken off from the pier, it's hilly territory. You see this train, you visualize this caravan of trucks going straight and round and round. And at one point, two trucks go another way. And they went to our battalion headquarters. We used to steal a lot of food like that. So.
And something tells me that there was some food consumed on the drive from the pier to your
battalion
headquarters. Oh,
and in the hole, we used to break open those cases like mad and eat the peaches and pears. Oh, we had a hell of a time until we loaded up our own two trucks. The word come in one day to the Marine Corps headquarters that we need two trucks, two work units, to go down to the Indianapolis to unload a ship. They called on the Marines to do this because the Army was there, but they didn't fool around with the Army. So when we went down to the docks, we figured everybody volunteered on those trips because, hey, we're going to eat.
You're going to get some food. Yeah.
So when we went down the dock, you've never seen so much brass in your life. We seen colonels, generals, majors, all over the place. Mm-hmm. Security was top. And we'd all look at each other, what the heck gives here? You know, let's get back in the hole and let's unload the ship. So we got down there in the hole, and all we seen was these big crates. So I says, okay, that's what they wanted loaded. You know, we didn't see any food.
Mm-hmm.
And we unloaded the crates on our trucks, and the trucks went to a certain spot on Tinian where there were dugouts for these two bombs, let's say now. These two crates were two bombs.
And you had no idea what's
nothing,
in the crates.
Not a thing. We didn't know anything about the bombs ready. We didn't know what we unloaded until the first day when Tibbetts took the B-29 and bombed Hiroshima. And then when they come back, that's the only time we found out that we had unloaded the A-bomb, two LA bombs.
And when you saw all the brass, all these big wigs walking around, did you think maybe there is something special in these crates?
Yeah, well, we gave it a thought.
Mm-hmm.
We gave it a thought. Where the hell's all this brass come from? You know, we made all our own comments, but nobody ever figured we were unloading bombs. We had no food, but all the crates were meant to be with the pieces of the bomb.
Well, and of course, and you and no one else had any idea what an atomic bomb was. Harry Truman didn't even know it existed till Roosevelt died and he became president.
That's right.
So this was a new thing to everybody. How did you find out that they had dropped the bomb on Hiroshima?
The next morning from out of San Francisco.
You heard it on the radio?
Oh, yeah, on the radio.
Did it click at that point?
Then we said, that's what we unloaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it came to us that's what it was unloaded. Then the other one was sent to August 9th, Nagasaki. Major Sweeney was the pilot of that plane.
Mm-hmm.
It was a frightful thing to think about, but it saved a heck of a lot of lives.
I've seen official military estimates from that period that put it at least a million American lives. And I'm sitting here talking to one of them because there's little doubt
We would have gone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because they were already... And boy, to land on Japan would have been a massacre, because you're going to, like anybody trying to land in the United States, you know, enemy, it's going to be murder all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ready to defend. They didn't care, but they didn't. Killing them were meant to nothing. They're all for the emperor.
Did you grasp immediately or how long did it take for you to realize this could save all of our lives, because we're probably going over there, and maybe this will bring the war to an end? Or was it not until they signed that surrender that you had that idea?
No, no one signed a surrender. We had that idea before that, but not right then and there. After we heard the news, oh, we saved all these lives. We didn't know they surrendered yet. After they surrendered, then we come to the conclusion of how many of us would have been saved. But the whole 6 divisions would go to Japan.
When Tibbetts came back to the island with the Enola Gay, did it seem any different than any other B-29 coming back from any other mission? Did you hear any kind of uproar? Or?
No.
Nothing?
After he dropped the bomb?
Mm-hmm.
No, we had no contact about that. We wouldn't know how they felt or anything.
You know, we had a guy on the program last year, a great gentleman from Visalia named Norris Jernigan, who was with that bomb group and talked about some of the briefings and how interesting that was. And he described Tibbetts. And there's been a lot of focus on Paul Tibbetts and the burden that he bore for the rest of his life for being that first person to drop that bomb. You said you had played ball with him before?
Yeah, we played ball with him. When they come over, they picked up a team to come over to play with us. And then when they left, the next day we didn't know if we see any of them.
Did he make an impression on you, the kind of person that he was?
No, we didn't know him. We were just another guy coming over to play ball.
Uh-huh.
No, not at all. We didn't know if he was a pilot or a bombardier or just a worker. I wanted the B-29s.
Well, I bring that up, and like I said, a lot of the attention has been paid to what he dealt with and his conscience and the big picture for everyone over there was how many lives it saved and not how many lives it took. But what about you? When you realized that you and your fellow Marines had along that path of getting those bombs to the Pacific, had unloaded them from the ship and taken them where they needed to go, did that do anything for you to realize that you played a role in maybe the most significant day in world history?
Well, while we were doing it, nothing.
Well, of course
we didn't
not.
Know what we were doing.
Right.
But after we found out, oh, yes, it was a big impression on all of us. Jeez, did we do that? You know, really meaning it in a group like we talk about it. It was unbelievable that instead of food, we unloaded a couple of atomic bombs. We didn't know what the hell an atomic bomb was anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, yes, the impression was there.
That was Marine Corps veteran Mo Rana, who wouldn't be able to claim he unloaded the components of the atomic bomb if the Indianapolis had been sunk before, not after, delivering that world-changing cargo. What a thin margin that was. And we'll hear from another survivor of the Indianapolis tragedy when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.